I'm fat, and if they don't make a sexy dress in my size, I'm gonna have one of my neighbors make one. Like, I'm going to the club. That was like sort of my first exposure to like, you can be fat and still be fly. You know, I went to one of the parties and the DJ pissed me off about something. And when I came home and was complaining about it, my roommate was like, why don't you just start your own party like you always say you're going to? I didn't remember having talked about starting my own party until he said that. But within a couple months, I had started my own party. I don't want to spend my weekends in this messy, dramatic club world. I just want to throw fun parties where people can get dressed up.
This is Who Hurt You, a podcast in which I deep dive into interesting people's brains to get them to tell me stuff they've never told anyone before. I'm Sophie Hagen, comedian, writer, influencer, hot guy. In order to introduce you to today's guest, I have to go back to the late 60s, when we saw the sort of official start to what we today see as the body positivity movement. In 1969, a man called Bill Fabray started NAFA, the National Association to Aid Fat Americans, the first fat acceptance group of its kind. In 1972, a chapter of NAFA called the Fat Underground formed and separated from NAFA as it didn't find NAFA to be radical enough. The first wave of fat acceptance was all about demolishing systemic fat phobia. The focus was not on fat people needing to love their bodies. It was about the system and how it needed to stop teaching people to hate their bodies. That's the brief description. Cut to today. Fat acceptance and fat liberation has been sugarcoated by thin people and is now seen as the more digestible body positivity, where we don't critique the system, we just focus on loving our curves. But NAFA still exists. It's now called the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. And it recently got a new chair. That's who I'm speaking to today. It's Tigress Osborne. She is here to get NAFA raised to a new level, one more inclusive of other types of oppression. She is a force of nature, and I felt quite starstruck to be talking to her. She's just pretty cool. I hope you'll enjoy our conversation. Here is Tigress Osborne.
Ciao. I'm sitting in my kitchen. There's a smell of burned bread because I heard the timer go off and then I ignored it. And now it doesn't taste that good. It's very dry. I'm angry at that. I'm also just feeling a bit Sunday-ish. It's a Sunday in April 2021. It's the afternoon. No, it's the evening, early evening for me. And early morning for Tigress Osborne that I'm going to speak to in a few seconds, because she's all the way over in the States, in the United States of America. My wonderful dog Hank is so far asleep. He's been very patient today because I've done some other recordings and we've not been able to play as much as he would have wanted, but we will do that straight after. I have showered today. That is a nice weekly event at this point. And I'm just feeling kind of excited about this chat we're about to have. So Tigress, where are you sort of emotionally and physically?
Physically, I'm in Phoenix, Arizona, which is in the southwestern part of the United States. And I am in the office of one of my beloveds for whom I am dog sitting. And he is a collector of many action figure-y things. So I don't know if you can see any of those in the background, but if you see superheroes, it's they're not just generally attracted to me. That's his collection. I am emotionally excited to be talking to you, beset by technical difficulties this morning. So a little bit frustrated and distracted by that, but confident that we have reached the end of them and that the rest of this is going to go smoothly.
Tell me about NAFA.
Yes.
Would you care to explain what that is?
Yes, sure. NAFA is the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. It's a fat rights organization that was founded in 1969. So we are about to be 52 years old. And we do advocacy work, education work. You know, NAFA, over the course of those 50 years, has been a lot of different things to a lot of people. As I'm sure you can imagine, you know, when an organization is that old, it kind of has, well, it basically has the same waves as fat activism has, right? The NAFA is the first like documented, organized fat activist group. And really started as sort of like a social and support group with some aims to like change the world and make the world better for fat people. But a lot of it was just like connecting fat people and affirming fat people and having community for fat people, and has always used the word fat people. So I'm going to use, the word fat to describe people. I do that in my life before NAFA, and NAFA has always done that. Just like fat activism sort of has three waves, like the, 70s, 80s activism, the 90s, early 2000s activism, and then the sort of like social media era of activism. NAFA kind of has those waves as well. So there are lots of different ways that people of different generations have experienced the organization. Once upon a time, we had chapters all over the country and people met locally and did social things together locally. We don't have those things anymore. We have a small operating board. We have volunteers who do stuff with us. And we're sort of in a like rebuilding and reassessing phase where we're trying to figure out like, what is the role of this organization with so much history in fat activist movement? But that hasn't always kept up to date with what the rest of the movement is doing. So we're sort of in that exploratory phase of figuring that stuff out.
That's so exciting. And what's your role in it at the moment?
So actually, I'm the new chair of the board of directors. And because we're a working board, that basically makes me the chair of the organization. It's an interesting role for me because this is only the second time that NAFA has had a person of color. I'm a mixed race Black American woman. And the first person was someone who was, her name is Phyllis War. I always want to honor her as the first Black chair of NAFA. And she also was only an interim chair who didn't really want to be the chair, but was holding the space when a chair suddenly died and while they were looking for another chair. So it's kind of the first time NAFA has had a Black leader who is I always have talked publicly about race. I come from a professional background of doing equity and inclusion and diversity work. So like I talk about different things than NAFA chairs have talked about historically. I'm really interested in, I feel like it's really essential that this organization either becomes more intersectional or gets out of the way of everyone else. I can't be the chair of an organization that is white-centered, cisgender-centered, heteronormative, all of those things, because that's not what my activist community has looked like in my years as an activist. That's not what my identities work. And so it's a really interesting time to be in charge of NAFA. And then, of course, I officially started January 1st, but I had COVID. And so it was a little bit of a slower start than I had hoped for. But I think we're off and running to like a different, building on some of the changes that we had started to make under the previous chair and figuring it out, like figuring out how to be relevant to folks, to be supportive of folks. We understand that we can't be all things to all fat people. But figuring out which things we can be. and so it is, you're right. I exciting is the right word for it. It's humbling. And sometimes it's a little scary because it's a lot of responsibility. But it is exciting.
I have many more questions about NAFA, but I want to be able to understand sort of your context within this. And for that, I'd like to sort of go back and see, so how from when you look at yourself as a child in your head, do you see many parallels to who you are now? Were you always meant to be this activist and fighting for the good? Or
I think so. I think there's definitely some roots of like you know, little social justice warrior tigress as a young person. I was just thinking the other night about this journal entry that I have from like seventh grade. Every once in a while I look back at my journals. I haven't looked at them in a while, but this one just always sticks with me. And it was something where I was writing about how if I were more popular, then the unpopular kids would not have a leader. It was like I had in this vision of myself as like queen of the geeks or something. And I think that I had, you know, it's interesting when I talk to people who knew me in my childhood, like their perceptions of me and my self-perception are sometimes very different. And some of that is very racialized, like where I grew up and I was in an honors program in school where I was one of the only Black kids in that program, but I lived in the Black neighborhood of my small town outside of Phoenix. And, you know, and I'm from a mixed race family. And like, there was a lot of sort of like, that thing white people do where they go like, you don't match my stereotypes of Black people, so therefore I just don't think of you as Black. And so like there was a lot of that kind of stuff in my childhood and in my coming of age. And then I definitely identified as a fat kid, you know, like by junior high, because people told me I was fat. If you look at pictures of me now, and especially like now being surrounded by the community that I'm surrounded by as an activist, I'm like, y'all do not know what fat is if you really think that this was a fat kid. But, you know, compared to cousins or whatever and just classmates, you know, I can remember being in fifth grade and talking about weight on the playground. And I had the highest weight. If you look at pictures of me with my fifth grade class, I don't look that much bigger than the kids, but obviously I had a different body type. And so some of those things were there, you know, and I grew up with these two very different fat aunts on the different side of my family. You know, I mean, I had a lot of fat aunts on one side of my family. I only have one aunt on the other side of my family and she's fat, but there are two of them that I sort of think of as like being really, instrumental to like the way I saw fat as a kid. And one of them was more like, I'm fat and therefore it's over for me. And the other one was more like, I'm fat. And if they don't make a sexy dress in my size, I'm going to have one of my neighbors make one. Like I'm going to the club, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, and I still remember like a lot of diet talk around me, even around that side of the family or in my neighborhood or whatever. But I think that was like sort of my first exposure to like, you can be fat and still be fly. And I don't know, I couldn't have seen it as NAFA in particular. Like even I learned about NAFA first when I was, 18, I guess I was in my first year of college and a woman who was part of Boston's NAFA chapter. I was on the East Coast at Smith College, and a woman who was part, Carrie Hemingway, who was part of Boston's NAFA chapter, did a presentation at our school's like annual diversity day about fat rights. And there were maybe 10 of us that went to her presentation, but it was, you know, I had seen NAFA people like on talk shows, Donahue and stuff like that. And people might vintage and older will remember Donahue. I don't know if you know the Phil Donahue show, but it was a super popular talk show here in the States. And it sort of like paved the way for shows like Oprah and Sally Jesse Raphael. There was like this explosion of talk shows in the 90s, but Phil Donahue was sort of like the grandfather of those shows. And so like I had seen NAFA people, I think if you saw fat people on television in the 80s talking about how it was okay to be fat, there's a really good chance that those were NAFA members. You know, there are some other organizations like the Fat Underground and there was a Boston Women's Collective that went by a bunch of different names over their years, but it all always had Boston and fat in some kind of way, and one in New Haven. So there were some other organizations, but NAFA was the bigger one. And the less radical one, so maybe more likely to go on shows like daytime talk shows. But so, you know, and I know in London there were some women doing similar things, but I don't know what their talk show world looked like. So here it was Donahue. and I had seen NAFA people, but I had not encountered them in real life. So I'd seen a little bit of fat positivity from a magazine called BBW, Big Beautiful Woman. which was like a mainstream print magazine. You couldn't find BBW magazine on like the shelves in your grocery store while you were checking out, but you could still find it fairly accessibly. It was in like Walden Books, which was a mall bookstore that was really popular in the 80s and 90s. And so I just discovered it at my local bookstore, and it was like fat women in nice clothes and, you know, sometimes fat celebrities, but most of it was targeted towards women. Most of it was like, fat, you know, like early fat fashion. I would never have said that. There was another publication called Radiance, which I had never found locally here and didn't know about until years later. So BBW magazine was kind of my introduction. And then I met this NAFA woman, and then I spent 10 years thinking about how I needed to lose weight and not really thinking about those things that much, and sort of rediscovered NAFA when I, in my early 30s, I was sort of a late bloomer to nightlife, and I started going out to clubs, and I was a smaller fat woman then, like probably like a size 16, 18 US women's sizes. And in the Bay Area where I was living, near Oakland and San Francisco in California, there is a lot more acceptance of a certain amount of body diversity in nightlife. It's not one of those places where like they don't let the fat girl in the club. Generally speaking, you know, there's a wide range of different ethnic groups who have larger body types. And so there's just like, you know, if you're a size 16, you're probably not going to be the only big girl in the club, but if you're size 26, that might look different. And so I started exploring, what most people referred to as BBW parties. There was a party here called Big Boogie Nights, and then later there was one called Sexy at Any Size. And then later there was one called Full Figure Entertainment, which was mine. Because part of what happened is I started going, and again, you know, I was a smaller plus size woman, and I'm a light-skinned Black woman. And I would go, and there would not be the same openness to my, you know, sometimes there wouldn't be the same openness to my larger friends. Sometimes there wouldn't be the same openness to my darker friends. In the Bay Area's BBW nightlife community, there was definitely, there was a dynamic that was very much about interracial dating that was specifically between Black men and white women. And it was partly because some of those clubs had started with people who knew each other from an interracial kink community. And it was just partly also because there are sort of different stereotypes and attitudes and beliefs at play about white women and about Black men than there are about Black women. And so it was like, I would go and, you know, the party would be fun. The music would be fun. There was a bunch of drama, you know, in the club world, in the plus size party community. But I mostly stayed at that partly because I was just not dating within that community. So I just didn't get embroiled in some of that drama. But you know, there was a point where it just really felt like, this is not my place, right? I love being here and seeing all these different kinds of bodies and fat women wearing these, you know, really fun clothes. But I want something more. I was still going to mainstream clubs, and I was seeing like the ambiance of those clubs was different than the parties, because the BBW parties were often in like hotel lounges or ballrooms or, you know, the bar at a hotel, which is not the same as like the lighting and the high-end DJ and all that other stuff of a bigger club. And so I got to the point where I was, I went to one of the parties and the DJ pissed me off about something. And when I came home and was complaining about it, my roommate was like, why don't you just start your own party like you always say you're going to? And I did not realize I didn't remember having talked about starting my own party until he said that. But within a couple months, I had started my own party. I had a couple of friends who supported me. I set up informational interviews with the other two club owners. And I was just like, you know, I am a community builder by day. I was a high school diversity teacher, you know, talking to high school students about like race and class and gender and sexual orientation. And so I was like, by day, I'm building community. I don't want to be in this, like, I don't want to spend my weekends in this, like, messy, dramatic club world. I just want to throw fun parties where people can get dressed up. So I sat down with the owners of the two other clubs because I was just like, you know, I'm trying to give us I'm trying to give us even more options. We are already lucky to be in the Bay Area where we have two plus size oriented nightclub parties. Most places in the country don't have any. We have two. And it's still, we could still use more variety. We have two, and there are also like 47 other clubs having parties tonight that people can go to. And only two of them are places that are explicitly welcoming of fat people. So we might be okay at the other ones, but these two are explicitly welcoming of fat people. And in fact, you know, celebrating fat people in most ways. I mean, definitely there were like sleazy guys there also that were just objectifying fat people. But so I was like, you know, I want to start another party. I don't want to be in some kind of weird, nasty competition with y'all. Like, and there was a lot of drama amongst the clubs. And so I was just, I don't want to do any of that. My goal was to have a party that looked like their nightclub parties, that it was not like the fat people have to settle for something different. Like, it's fine to be in a sports bar or a hotel lounge or whatever sometimes, but we should also get the chance to have that club experience with the fancy lighting and everybody's dressed up and the bartenders are doing things at the bar. You know, it's not just like the hotel manager's cranky old uncle is running the bar or whatever, like just to have that sort of nightlife experience. So I started, you know, so I met with the other folks, like, can we have, like, I get it. It's still business. Like, it's still competition, but I'm not going to try to directly compete with y'all the way you do with each other. Cause they would do stuff like have parties on the same night across the street from each other. And I'm like, we only have these parties for fat people. Can we spread this out? And I did make a commitment to like, to centering women of color. You know, I was thinking mostly about women because I was thinking, because it started with me and my friends. Like, I wanted to be, you know, an LGBTQ friendly club. I wanted to be thinking about like, what can we do to support fat people when it's not club night? Like, how can we, you know, I want to throw the hottest party in town on Friday nights. And then the rest of the week, what else? And so that's when I started like really exploring other size acceptance, fat activist kind of stuff in the Bay Area, because I wanted to make sure that my club had a backbone of across the country. There were a lot of BBW club promoters who were just like guys who like big asses and want to have access to a lot of women with big asses. And I just like, that's not my little feminist heart, and me as a, you know, female business owner and woman of color. And like I said, doing this other kind of work by day, I just needed to have, you know, something else that brought more substance to it. And like, it's fine to just be a party promoter and just be throwing a party. That's just not who I was. I needed to bring all of those elements together. And so I hosted Full Figure Fridays in the Bay and at a couple of like BBW bashes, which are sort of like weekend long or week long social events, like party conventions. I always call it Fat Girl Spring Break, but it is like, you know, so I hosted my party at a couple of those, but mostly I was Bay Area based. And the thing about the Bay Area as a place to grow as a fat activist is that there is so much history in the Bay Area. And there were so many people from those couple of different stages of fat activism who lived in the San Francisco and Oakland area. And so it was like, I would have things like, you know, when I first read, I remember the first time I saw Marilyn Wan's book, Fatso, on a bookshelf. I was in Richmond, California at a Barnes & Noble, and I was just walking through, and there's this book with this fat lady dancing on the cover. It's like a cartoon of a fat lady dancing. And it says, fat, exclamation point, so, question mark. And I was like, oh my God, yes. And I did not know that Marilyn Wan lived in San Francisco and that I would meet her one day and become friends with her. So, you know, and there were just over and over experiences like that in the Bay Area, because there was such a collective of people who were fat studies scholars or fat artists or fat models or whatever. And so it was a great place to kind of grow up as an activist in my 30s.
I feel like there's an aspect of activism where in order to do it without being completely run down yourself. You have to sort of be able to separate logic, statistics, science, you know, one part of the brain from emotions and trauma and irrationality and all of those sort of the other part of the brain. I don't know if you can sort of relate to what I'm saying with this. I feel like there's a lot of cross-contamination between people going into activism as more of a way to express their anger or their sort of trauma reactions. And then there's this aspect of it that is more about actually organizing and almost more admin-based than education-based. Does that ring a bell to you? Am I right in that assumption?
Well, I think people enter in lots of different ways, right? But I do think you're right that a lot of times people enter into activism because something funky happened to them. Right? They've experienced discrimination. They got tired of not being able to find clothes, or they had a medical discrimination situation. I think that's one of the most motivating ones for a lot of people, actually. But I also think that the hatred of fat is so deeply pervasive in our culture. I think that the internalization of the hatred of fat is so common and so deeply ingrained for so many people that often when people experience injustice because of their body shape or size, they just look for ways to change their body shape or size. They don't think about, it seems like way too big of a chore to try to change the world. If I can't fit an airline seat, me trying to change the entire airline industry's policies about that seems a lot harder than me just losing 40 pounds so I can fit the damn seat, right? Except the truth is it's actually equally hard in some ways, just differently hard, because most of us are not going to experience permanent weight loss if we're fat. And so, whether you believe that's for all of the scientific reasons that people who don't start research with the idea that fat is a disease and needs to be cured, you know, have shown us about weight loss and weight loss dieting, or whether you do believe all of those people who start their research that way and think it's just a matter of willpower, either way, it's not working for the vast majority of the world, the vast majority of the time. So you actually might have a better chance at changing an airline's policy than you have at changing your wide hips, right? But we're not taught to think about it that way. And so sometimes I think it is like people get revolutionized into activism by meeting other activists or by hearing about other activists. You know, I mentioned Marilyn Juan a couple minutes ago. When I was in my early 20s and living in San Francisco, and like I said, I had heard about NAFA in college, but I hadn't experienced NAFA. And so I was out there on my own. I'm like a little, chunky 21-year-old, and I don't have a fat activist community around me. I'm on my way to work, and I hear on the radio about this protest that is happening in San Francisco. There was a billboard that 24 Hour Fitness put up that had a picture of an alien on it, and it said, when they come, they'll eat the fat ones first, or something like that. And all these angry fat people organized and picketed in front of this gym. A gym, right? The place where we're not, you're not supposed to go to the gym if you're fat. You're supposed to magically lose weight without going to the gym so you can go to the gym as a thin person. And so there's all these angry fat people protesting outside of 24 Hour Fitness about this, about this stigmatizing advertising campaign that they were doing. I'd never heard of anything like that. Even having known a little bit about NAFA existing, the idea that you could just take to the streets and be like, F you guys, we don't have to let you say stuff like this about us. That was revolutionary to me to hear about that. But the vast majority of Americans have never heard of that protest, right? The vast majority of people around the world have never heard of that protest. It's only when you stumble your way into fat activist circles and begin to learn that history, that you start to have sort of a wider base of examples of those kinds of things from people's own daily protests, like the way they talk to their own doctors about the way their doctor talks about weight, to, you know, to the idea that if you wear a size 6X, you should have clothes, not you should not have clothes. You not you should just have ugly clothes until you're a size 2X or whatever. Like, the more you're exposed to people like that, from, I don't know, for me, it's like a duplicating process. Like, the more I'm exposed to badass fat people, the more badass I feel, and the more I attract other badass fat people. So I think what happens sometimes is that, you know, the question that you asked about sort of separating, like, the logical sort of academic discussions around fat from the, like, the trauma and the hurt. Some people can't even get past the word fat because the trauma and the hurt is so deep. So there are people who are exposed to fat activism and go, wow, you can say it's okay to be who you are. And there are other people who are like, I like those ideas, but I don't want to call myself fat because the only way I've heard that in my life is as an insult. And, you know, those trauma pieces don't magically go away just because you're exposed to activism. We still live in a culture that is deeply, deeply fat hating. And what that means is you are likely to encounter the voices, like literal voices, and also all the other imagery that sort of make up the cultural voice, you are way more likely to encounter on a regular basis the idea that your body is wrong than you are to encounter the idea that your body is okay. Even once you get exposed to fat activism, even when fat activists are roaring in comparison to the sounds of the rest of the culture, that can feel like this little tiny whisper, you know? But it's a life-saving whisper for a lot of people. Just the acknowledgement that it is trauma is a huge thing. I was talking to someone the other day about how when I was in my 20s, I used to drive around my car listening to the book on tape of Oprah Winfrey's Make the Connection. And as a 20-something, I thought that I was like, you know, if I can't be exercising because I'm stuck in traffic, I should be exercising because I'm too fat, so I should be exercising. But if I can't be exercising, at least if I am listening to this book about how to change my life by losing weight, by osmosis, I will be getting all of these, like, you know, support for when I do go to the gym, right? But I realized in this conversation I was having the other day that actually what was making me feel the most supported about that book was the section of the book where Oprah talks about how hard it was to be fat. Mm-hmm. Because I just had the sense that, that, like, if people weren't harassing you on the street, then it was all in your head. You know, if you weren't one of those people that was like, or if you weren't like Gilbert Grape's mom, then, you know, then you just were, you know, you just needed to get over it, lose some weight, and, you know, like, move your fat ass and, you know, and stop being such a baby. And, like, but there was this section of the book, most of the book is about, like, her trainer and her diet and whatever, how she ran a marathon, blah, blah, blah. But, like, there's this section of the book where she's just talking about what motivated her to do those things. You could have that same section of that memoir where she talks about, like, how embarrassing it was that her stylist had to buy two size 10 outfits and sew them together to make her a size 20 outfit, or how humiliated she was because she went to see Mike Tyson fight and she weighed more than the heavyweight champion of the world. Like, you could hear those things not as, this is the story of how hard it is to be fat and why I had to change myself to conform to society. You could hear those in somebody else's memoir as, these are the things that happened to me that were traumatic around fatness because the culture is traumatic around fatness. And they are the things that radicalized me to try to make the world a better place.
I mean, that was what happened for me. It was the perspective changed in my head. It went from these are all the horrible things I'm experiencing because I have failed because I am fat. And it changed to, these are all the horrible things that I'm experiencing because the world is super fucked up. Yeah. And I'm actually not a failure. I'm just being alive and fat at the same time.
Yeah, I'm just being alive and fat at the same time. And like, that's not hurting anybody. The idea that, like you said, like, I'm just living my life as a fat person. And the ways in which I'm experiencing failures that are specific to being a fat person largely have to do with the ways the culture is failing me. You know, or the way that the world is not made for me, or the way that we act like there are not millions of other fat people and I'm the only one. And, you know, that idea, I mean, I also had not ever questioned the authority of science, right? The idea that they, capital T, say that it's unhealthy to be fat and therefore it must be. And, you know, the more you learn about, like, it makes you sound like a conspiracy theorist in some ways. Like, the more you learn about the information that's being withheld from you, the more you will see that the story is all a lie. And yet, the more you hear about the information that is being withheld from you, the more you will see that the story is a lie. Because, you know, one of the other books that really changed my mindset in my 20s was Laura Fraser's Losing It, which is a critical analysis of the diet industry. Mm. And it was the first time I was exposed to the idea that you could ask questions about the diet industry, that it wasn't just a given that these people are trying to help you become more healthy by losing weight. So not only did it help me learn to question capitalism in general, you know, like, why, for example, would there be a boom in, you know, what some people call weight loss surgery is what a lot of people in fat activist community called stomach amputation. Like, why would there be a boom in that kind of surgery? Is it really because we're all so much fatter and in so much more danger? Or is it because people figured out a way to make a tremendous amount of money off of that surgery? Right? Once you ask that question, then it's easier to ask the next question about, like, well, what else could be operating this way? You know, what else is maybe motivated by something other than my best interest?
Yeah.
And this is one of the differences to me between, like, body positivity, which is like, girl, love yourself, you know, versus like fat activism, which is like, let's burn it all down, you know, like, or some degree of that, right? I mean, there are lots of different ways to claim an identity as a fat activist, and not everybody is like, burn down the whole system. But at least most of us are like, can we at least question the system, though? Like, you know, whereas a lot of body positivity is like, you know, is very individually focused. Like, you just learn to be the goddess you are. And a lot of it is very gendered towards, you know, cisgender women or femmes. And, you know, so you just be the goddess you are and don't let anybody stop you, girl. And that is a very different orientation to critiquing the culture than, hey, let's look at where the money is behind this shit that is telling us that everybody fat is going to die. That kind of politicized orientation to body acceptance, first of all, is about not just me. It's not just, do I like my body? It's, are people allowed to live in their bodies freely? And that's just more of a community investment that I'm interested in. Just like, of course, I want to get through the day and I want to have clothes that I like and I want to get paid the same on my job and, you know, not have a doctor who's an asshole to me just because of the size of my, you know, my weight on the scale or whatever. I want to have all those things for myself. I also don't want to be the only one who has them. You know, that sort of way, that book was the first time I learned to question the diet industry that way. And to think about these, like, gurus, diet gurus of the early 90s, Richard Simmons, Susan Powder, you know, it's like, you know, what can I take from what they have to offer? And what can I just not take from that? Because that's ridiculous. You know, like, I love looking back at Richard Simmons videos, because if you watch Richard Simmons videos from the 80s and 90s with the sound off, what you see is fat people in joyful movement.
That's interesting.
Like, what you see is fat people in colorful outfits enjoying dancing together in community. And you don't have Richard Simmons screaming at them about, like, you fed it, so you lift it. Like, you don't have any of that shit. You just have fat people dancing together. It's actually more fat visibility than we had anywhere else during that era, right? This is an era where there's, like, one fat. There was this, I don't know if you know about this, there was a fat girl sitcom, Babes, that came on the Fox network when it was a brand new network. And it had, I'm blanking on all three of the actresses' names, but you can find it on YouTube. And it's about these three fat girls who were sisters. And it had all kinds of, you know, stereotypes about how fat people eat. But it was also just like, it was three fat girls in clothes that were, you know, not, they didn't look like what was mainstream popular, but they were fabulous clothes. They were not hiding their bodies. I mean, they were hiding their bodies in the sense that it was like the caftan era of, like, everybody is in a muumuu type thing. You know, some of which was people's style and some of which was accessibility to other kinds of clothes and the belief of manufacturers that we wouldn't wear things that came close to our roles. So they didn't look like fabulous outfits as what we would see fabulous outfits today, or what you and I would see as fabulous outfits today. But it was like, you know, but they weren't just all wearing black because it was slimming, and they were dating and living their lives. And it was like one season, maybe it was only even half a season on the Fox network before The Simpsons made Fox like the network, and the In Living Color and all those shows made Fox blow up. A lot of people don't remember it because, you know, it was like this fledgling network at the time. If you know anything about the history of television in the US, I totally encourage your listeners, Sophie, to look it up on YouTube, because it's just like this great, like, time capsule piece from the 90s about fat visibility. But that was it. There weren't characters on TV shows who were fat. It was like, you know, Christopher Farley was on Saturday Night Live, and that's it. You know, like, there were not, you know, and then it was like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's drawing at the beginning of his movies, like, that's the only place, and Santa, like, that's the only place you can see fat people. So if you were watching Richard Simmons exercise videos, you were seeing fat people all the time. If you were watching talk shows, you were seeing fat people all the time. But, you know, the visual was there, but the content was always about weight loss. And so the idea of, like, fat people getting together to just have fun and have joyful movement without the goal of that being weight loss is revolutionary. You know, and it's the kind of thing that organizations like NAFA and, you know, and these party, you know, organization, party businesses and the badges and that kind of stuff that all, you know, made those things accessible to fat people.
So what is happening at the moment within NAFA, and I guess within fat activism in general, when it comes to taking racism into account? Dr. Sabrina Springs published the book Fearing the Black Body, which, gave us something to point to and go, this, like, read this, please. And I feel like you've talked a bit about the start of NAFA and sort of the centralization of whiteness. What's happening now? What happened then? What's happening within the movement? I know that's a bit of a big question.
Well, it is a big question, but it's a really important question. I think that, so it's important to know that even though NAFA did not do that well from the beginning, that's why there were other activist groups, because a lot of early fat activism actually came out of radical feminism. So that meant it was still pretty white a lot of times, because it looked like what we now refer to as white feminism. But I think that because those folks were more radical, as they continued to progress through the movement, they became more aware of intersectional issues faster than what we now refer to as white feminism. There is, you know, the Fat Underground was started in the LA area. I think some of those women lived in San Francisco too, but I think it was started in the LA area. And it was like radical feminists who were like, NAFA is not radical enough. And you can find their Fat Manifesto online. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Sophie. Have you ever seen the Fat
Manifesto? I have.
Yeah.
I had it printed in my book as well.
Oh, okay. I'm still waiting for my copy of your book to come. So I know you in all of your online ways, but my actual hard copy, I don't have in my little hands yet. The Fat Manifesto is great and explicitly says we align ourselves with other social justice causes. Right? NAFA does not say anything like that explicitly and implicitly says other social justice causes are great doing what they're doing over there, but it's kind of a distraction to us talking about fat people stuff. So when you come here, can we just focus on the fat people stuff? That's what we have in common. Until about just a handful of years ago, I could not say the word, you know, I know intersectionality as a phrase that is more popularly understood is relatively recent, right? We know it comes from Kimberly Crenshaw's work around law and justice. And it's only in the last like few years that we've started to talk about it more widely. But the idea of there are ways that our multiple identities intersect, and especially ways that they intersect to keep systems working against us, that is an idea that should have been present in the mind of all activists who care about justice and liberation, right? But in fact, what I would encounter in my early days in the activist movement, which again are in the like middle age of activism, like I started my nightclub in 2008. So I'm sort of there at the beginning of the, you know, like the Instagram body positivity movement, but I'm not there at the beginning of fat activism, right? I'm not even born at the beginning of fat activism. I'm 46 and, you know, and NAFA is 52. What I found when I got into activism and I showed up in the activist world, like everybody wants to care about these other social justice things. And people be like, oh, why are you talking about race all the time? You know, and there's a pervasive idea amongst fat people who are privileged in many other categories of identity that anti-fatness is the last acceptable prejudice. And it's the most ridiculous phrase I've ever heard, because if you look around the world, and it's literally almost always literally phrased that way. Last acceptable prejudice, last acceptable kind of discrimination. And it's all, and the example is always, if you made a joke like that about a gay person or a black guy, they'd be canceled. Like the world would end if I said something like that about somebody black, but people could just say anything they want to about fat people. First of all, no. Racism is abundant in this world, and I'll blame my homeland for the, like, racism is abundant. It's uniquely created in the United States in very particular ways, and it exists everywhere, but we have a particular kind that has been perfected here and then exported out into the world, and for capitalist reasons as a justification for slavery, all the things, right? So racism is here. And also, did you have to go to the Supreme Court to get permission to marry as a fat person? You did not. So yes, there are very real and very serious ways that anti-fat discrimination ruins people's lives. It's not just like, do you feel bad about yourself in the mirror? It is things like, can the government take your children from you because they are too fat or because you are too fat? It is things like, you know, can you be denied a life-saving surgery because you're told that you're too big for it? It is things like, are you getting paid less on your job, or could you just be fired from your job if your boss doesn't like fat people? And also, anti-fat discrimination can be a backdoor way of discriminating in those other areas where you can't legally discriminate. You can just make up something about how fat people can't live in your building anymore. And what can they do about it? Like, they're going to, you know, they can take you to court, but they want to try to become the first set of case law about that kind of court case. But there's not already existing legality that supports you in that way, right? So we don't want the standard for whether or not we are able to live freely and whether we're being treated fairly in the world to be, are people still allowed to make jokes about me on TV? That's not the standard, right? And there are people who it's not socially acceptable to make some of those jokes, although, you know, our last president shifted a lot of that, what is socially acceptable, back by many, many years. But even if it's true that it's not socially acceptable to make certain kinds of jokes, if those people are still being shot in the back by the police, you know, prevented from having other legal rights, told they can't use certain kinds of bathrooms because of who they are, then there's no such thing as last acceptable prejudice. We don't have to be making those kinds of comparisons. There are serious and legit reasons that anti-fat discrimination is a fucking problem, and we don't have to compare it to other things to establish that it is a problem. But the problem is that within fat community, and especially for people who are new to fat community and haven't had those kinds of dialogues, there is still that sort of entry energy sometime of like, I've had enough of being the only one that people can still pick on all the time. And then it's like, hi, fat Black woman here. Also, there are some other things that I've had enough of. Hey, and imagine how much this person has had enough of, you know, of the world being totally ableist or the world being totally ageist or the world being totally homophobic. Like, you're not in this, you're not in discrimination by yourself. So why don't we get together on some solidarity type vibes to work on this?
I'm nodding frantically.
Yeah. And so then what happens is, over the course of fat activist history, there are people who came into fat activism by way of other activism. There are also a lot of people who get into other kinds of social justice activism because fat activism is their gateway. It's the first time somebody's made them think about privilege in a systemic way and where they do have privilege versus where they don't. And how, even if you have disadvantage as a fat person, if you're a fat white person, if you're a fat wealthy person, if you're a fat straight or cisgender person, like, you have privilege that other people don't have. So how can you leverage your privilege to help those other communities fight their oppression? And how can we work together with other communities who are fighting oppression? The thing is, Sandra Salovey, who is a fat legal scholar and lawyer who's done like a million important things about protecting fat people's rights over her lifetime, often reminds us that if we protect the most disadvantaged fat people, that actually benefits all the fat people. Right. So if you start with like fat, white, straight people who are middle class and above, and you get them protected, that doesn't trickle down anywhere else. That doesn't expand out anywhere else. If you start with marginalized people who are marginalized in other ways in their body, people of color, you know, trans and gender nonconforming people, you know, other people who are not straight, like, you know, people who are disabled, elderly, people with certain medical conditions, whatever. If you protect those people first, it protects all of the other fat people too. And so I think that fat activism, at least in the, you know, I think younger fat activism or people who, younger fat activists or people who are newer to fat activism have come into activism at a time where there's just more conversation around intersectionality in general. So they tend to have some of that as like a built-in feature of what they think activism is. I think for NAFA and for other organizations that have been around for a while, we're all at various stages of grappling with our history of being like super white, super, you know, cishet centered, you know, cisgender, heterosexually centered organizations. And for me, one of the most beautiful things that happened with NAFA is at our 50th anniversary conference, Bill Fabry, who's the founder of NAFA, stood up and said, I have to take responsibility for my role in this not being an intersectional organization. he's a 70 something straight white cisgender man who, you know, he like, he spent his career as an engineer. Like, so he's not like some broke ass white dude, you know, like he has all these privileges and like, I don't want to spend too much time like, yay, white guy with all the privileges for finally doing it. I don't mean it like that. But I think it is really important that he owned that, that he said, you know, part of the reason this organization was not intersectional for many years of its management is because I was one of the people who thought like, well, we're here to talk about fat stuff. We're not here to talk about that other stuff. And so, you know, nobody, I don't think anybody in NAFA was like, at least, and I don't think anybody in NAFA's, leadership was actively going like, we must keep the black people from talking about race and we must keep those gays from talking about, it wasn't that sinister, right? But it was just that, you know, people start from who they are, and then if no one makes them question the privilege of who they are, they don't think about who other people are in the community that might also have needs. Maybe it was that sinister for some people, you know. I'm never going to not say that there aren't some cishet white men who have sinister motives. But I do think, like, even for the people whose intention was the best, right, their best intention was, we got to talk about this fat stuff separately from that. And I think even for the people whose intentions were the best, that like, well, but if we get these, you know, if we make the world better for fat people, that includes all those other fat people. They still thought of them as those other fat people, not like, we're all in this together. And so I think it was really important that Bill made that public statement about that. And then we had him do it on our NAFA webinar. We have a webinar series where we have, you know, people who do interesting things in fat community come on and talk about what they're doing and share from their lives. And we had him do that there. So it would be like recorded for all time. The founder of NAFA said, I messed this up and I am trying to be a part of helping undo it and make it better. And, you know, and Bill's been involved in a bunch of other fat organizations since his days with NAFA. And I think, you know, a lot of that learning came to him through like the people of color and LGBTQIA people in those organizations. So I think that learning for Bill, you know, like, I don't want to totally speak for Bill and I don't want to spend too much more time talking about the, about the cishet straight white guy. But I think a lot of that Bill, I want to say that a lot of that learning for Bill and for other activists of Bill's vintage, and for people of all ages who need this lesson, comes from the emotional labor of the more marginalized people in the community. So one of the tricky things I think for us to figure out at the next stage is, how do you have more people of color, more LGBTQIA people spotlighted in the work without just making that a lot more labor from them? What is the labor that people with privilege need to be doing so that we hear the voices of people who have less privilege, but we're not doing everything on their and our backs all the time. And that's a tricky balance. You know, one of the things I have some challenge with in NAFA is like, you know, there are, like, we want to be, we've historically been an all volunteer organization. We never paid anybody for anything. People volunteer to do stuff. What that meant was a lot of like retired white ladies volunteered to do stuff. And like, thank God for them and their labor. But also, if you never have the 20 something black activists because they can't afford to do it for free, you're failing as an organization. So how do you balance that, especially when you have a super limited budget? And so paying for one thing means not paying for something else. How do you reprioritize what the organization spends money on? Speaking of 20-something amazing black activists, I just want to give a shout out to Deshaun Harrison, because you mentioned Dr.
Sabine. I love them.
Yeah, and Deshaun has a book coming out in, I think, August called Belly of the Beast, which is also about, you know, examining the connections between racism and anti-fatness.
Just they did the podcast a couple of years ago, I think, and I want them on again because I love them so much.
Yes, same. And I think that, you know, when you look for them, there are lots of, like, we have this, we just need to actively, people need to be actively looking for people of color in fat community to listen to read, to buy their projects, to, you know, pay for their art, to like all of that kind of stuff. You know, but it's challenging for some people who are used to fatness looking like everyone looks like Tess Holliday, you know, and or everyone looks like them and they are, you know, they are a 50-year-old white woman, or they are, you know, a thin white guy who likes fat girls, or like whatever. They like, people are used to thinking about the, you know, your story starts with you. And that makes sense to a certain extent. The problem is when you dig in really hard, we do see some pushback. We are doing things like, you know, we added, Darlene Howell, who was the chair before me, added a column to our newsletter called Anti-Racism Resources. And she is an, you know, a retired white cis straight woman who is really committed to becoming a better ally, to be building her skills as an ally to other communities. And so as she started researching resources for herself, she started compiling them for NAFA, for the for our newsletter every month. And they go on our website and you can find them at NAFA.org if you're listening. I think it's under the education tab. And she, you know, we've gotten some pushback from that. Like, why are you guys wasting your time talking about racism? You're supposed to be concentrating on fat people. Yeah, you know, there are fat people of color who would like to not be enduring racism, especially in our own organizations, right? We don't have time to talk about that. Back in my day, we wouldn't have been wasting time with that, right? And back in your day, you lost a lot of members of NAFA because of that. NAFA is not the mighty organization of fatness that it was, you know, when it was the only game in town, because all the people that y'all were like, we don't really want to talk about your stuff, started other stuff. So they're doing other stuff now. We could all be doing stuff together. It doesn't have to be through NAFA, but it could be through NAFA. NAFA has all this history to leverage and, like, you know, and history of being really visible in media in some ways and stuff like that. Like, we could be leveraging that to help everybody instead of people running out of here because you all want to act like we can't talk about anything else. But that's, so we're, and I'm sure the other organizations are seeing it. I think all of the other sort of major organizations that do things like this, well, I want to give a shout out to Fat Rose, because I think Fat Rose from the ground up has just been like, we are intersectional, we are radical, we're going to do things in ways that historically fat organizations did not do things. You know, and I think No Lose, which started as an organization specifically of fat lesbians, and it centers LGBTQIA folks better than other organizations do. Like, there are organizations that have historically done this better than NAFA, or that did it from their very roots better than NAFA did it from the roots. All of the organizations that didn't have intersectionality at their roots are doing some kind of figuring out, we either have to be more intersectional or we're going to be irrelevant. And we should be more intersectional because it's the right thing to do, not just because it threatens the future of our organization to not do it. But also, like, we're going to be more intersectional, or I'm not going to be part of NAFA. So I don't even know what regular members are going to do. Like, I'm the chair. And if we can't be successful at increasing intersectionality in this organization, I won't be the chair anymore. And I'll be over there in Fat Rose. Like, and I just, but I do think that there is, you know, someone asked me, actually, Ivy Felicia, who runs Fat Women of Color, asked me a really smart question. She asked me, you know, if you know that this is NAFA's history with all of this lack of intersectionality and lack of making space for women of color, like, why did you want to do this instead of just starting something yourself? Well, first of all, I've been through starting something myself, because that's what my nightclub was like. It was very POC centered and, you know, especially Black and Brown centered and, you know, and feminist and like all of the things. And, So I've done that. And I did, I think I was successful as a community builder in that way. I wasn't successful as a businesswoman, like still paying off debts from when I ran the club. So I wasn't successful as a businesswoman, but I think that I'm really proud of the community connections that were built through those years that I did the club and the friendships that were made and, you know, and the couple that got married and has the most adorable baby on the internet, you know, like all of that stuff I'm super proud of. But I think we can leverage that history so that it is beneficial specifically to some of the people who were left out of NAFA historically, and, you know, who felt like, eh, it's not really right for me. Some of that is like, we are, NAFA is, I think, needs to be as an organization more moderate than I personally am, right? So like, the like, because NAFA needs to be a gateway organization for people. It needs to be the, like, you're like, it's just radical enough that we're even calling ourselves fat in here. We're going to baby step you through some of this stuff. There are people who are ready to jump that, jump it and get right to the things that No Lose are doing, the things that Fat Rose are doing, some of the things that Ivy Felicia is doing with fat women of color that are just more like, we're already in this. Now show us who you are. Right. I think NAFA needs to be the training camp in some ways. And the entry point for people in some way. So we have to figure out, like, there's a baseline of, like, we must hold ground on these things because we're not going to let you just come in and, like, you can't just come in and be blatantly racist because we know that you need time to learn a little bit more about racism. Like, we're going to hold ground on some things. You know, if you're messaging NAFA talking about like, oh, I see those Black Lives Matters people got to you finally, then we're going to write back and say, maybe you should let them get to you too. Here's some information you could learn from, right? We're not going to say, thanks for your message. Welcome to NAFA, fellow fat person. I think that the next stage for NAFA is really digging into some of the legislative work around getting some of those legal protections. And I think whether you like it or not, it does take a little bit of being moderate to do that because the super radicals who are trying to burn the system down are not only not the ones that the system's going to listen to, but also they're not the ones who want to do that work. They, even if they see the importance in that work, they're not the ones who necessarily want to do it. So I think as we begin to like really dig into that work around legal rights, one of the things that is troubling to me and that is frustrating to me is that if I want to see legislation passed that protects fat people, that includes the fat people who hate me for other reasons. You know, if I... you know, the fat lady who has that meme on her page that says, you know, that masks are the same as slavery. I don't want to be around her at all in any part of life until/unless she learns something about how fucked up that is. And also, if I want to see legislation passed that protects fat people, that includes her. So one of the challenges is like, so how do we deal with that? Right? How do we deal with that if that person wants to be active, if that person wants to be volunteer on a NAFA committee? you can't because you're racist, but we'll still be over here trying to protect your rights as a fat person so that you can live long enough to unlearn your racism.
That is, it's just so interesting. And I mean, I think this might be the first podcast episode where I've taken notes as if it was a class. I'm like, oh yeah, oh, I have to look that up and I have to know more about that and right, radical. And I have a million more questions for you. And you're such a professional, you've basically already done the wrapping up work for me. Because you've already sort of plugged your stuff. We're running out of time, so as soon as this is over, I'm going to ask you if you want to do it again at another point to talk more about stuff for another episode, because there's so much and I want to know everything. And I find this so incredibly fascinating. You've verbalized some points about activism that it's just so clear to me now, and it's so helpful. And I'm sure so many of my listeners are sort of like me, a bit sort of wannabe activists, or, you know, not really knowing what we're doing, but we'd love to do good things. And you've just, I think this is going to be so helpful. So I just want to ask, because you've been, thank you for doing this, first of all, like, thank you so much. Can we see these webinars, and how can we help NAFA? Where can we find information? Just sort of plug what you want the listeners to know before I set you free back into the world.
Yes. Okay. So our website is NAFA.org, NAAFA.org. And you can find a lot of our stuff on there. We're on most social media as at NAFA official, no spaces, just NAAFA and the word official. And on Facebook, we are facebook.com/equalityateverysize, which has kind of been, you know, NAFA's hashtag and tagline for a long time. You can see the webinars on our YouTube channel, which is NAFA official on YouTube. So we do our webinars live, and people can sign up for those on Zoom, and you can always see which ones are coming up on our website or on our, we post them as Facebook events, and you can, you know, and we tweet about them and all the things. So, if you are able to join us live for a webinar, then you have the opportunity to ask the person questions in the chat. Otherwise, we put the unedited webinars up on YouTube, and we're working on getting them all transcribed so that is available for people who find that useful or need that. We are behind on that, and we're working on it. But the webinars, I think we had a total of 22 webinar guests last year. We really ramped that program up during, you know, pandemic era, but we want to keep it going at that pace. So we also have what's called the FAT Community Grants Program, where people can apply for mini grants of up to $500 for projects that they want to do in FAT community. And I want to give a shout out to No Lose there too, because it was inspired by their grant program. So that's another place you could look to for money if you are trying to do something in your own community about supporting FAT people. And we're super, super excited because this year we are celebrating the first ever FAT Liberation Month. And we're doing that in May of 2021. So if you're listening to this later, you can find all of that stuff on our social media and YouTube. But if you're listening to this before May of 2021, then be on the lookout, because there are going to be a lot of really fun activities, extra webinars. We're having a kickoff with Angry Fat People. If you don't know them, they are fantastic. They do a YouTube show, and they're opera singers who do work in the world of opera about, you know, about size awareness kind of stuff. And lots of other things coming onto the calendar that we're still getting solidified for that. So we are super excited to do the first. We believe this is the first ever Fat Liberation Month. We have not, there have been a few people who've used that as a hashtag for like their personal things. I want to give credit to Clark Beltran, who wrote about wishing we had a Fat Liberation Month in NAFA's newsletter, and to Juana Tango, who then commented saying like, we should have that. And that kind of inspired us to go into conversations about like, yes, we should have that. So we are planning programming for that, but we also encourage other organizations, other people individually, to just do things in May to celebrate fatness and to learn more about fat history. So May in the US is also Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. So we encourage people to spend time learning about that community as well, and celebrating that community and protecting that community, which is something that is very needed right now in the US. So we, you know, we think people are capable of learning many things at the same time. So you don't have to celebrate Fat Liberation Month at the expense of Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. You just have to do some stuff to celebrate both communities. So that's like our main project that's coming up. Of course, we'll continue the webinar series throughout the rest of the year as well. Like, we have some extra ones planned for Fat Liberation Month, but we'll continue that throughout the rest of the calendar year. So those are the main things with NAFA.
Amazing. That is so, oh, I can't wait for May. That's going to be so much fun.
I'm really excited about it. I think people are going to be really excited. And I think, you know, this is the first year, and the more it, I think it's going to, you know, snowball into something that our hope is that it snowballs into something out that we don't really own, you know, that like we're not starting it for it to be NAFA's Fat Liberation Month every year. We're starting it to be like the community's Fat Liberation Month every year. And here are the things NAFA does during that month. And what are the exciting things the rest of you are doing all over the world? You know, NAFA is very US focused, and it's something that we want to work on as well. You know, there is global activism, and we need to be better about knowing the specifics of what's happening in other places. Americans are arrogant that way in all ways, and NAFA has been guilty of that. But yeah, but that's our biggest thing coming up right now is Fat Liberation Month. We're super, and the rest of it is like we're super excited about Fat Liberation Month, and the rest of it is some of that internal work. What are we doing to strengthen ourselves as an organization so we can be more intersectional, so we can have a strong future, so that we can have a bigger budget? I mean, if you're out there and you have money, people think NAFA has a lot more money than we actually have. We actually have a really small budget for a national nonprofit. So, you know, if you have something to contribute to that, if you like the things that you're hearing about what we're trying to do as an organization, you can also give to us at the NAFA.org website. And it's, you know, and it's super supportive, and, you know, and we prioritize the most marginalized people in our community in terms of paying people for stuff. So, you know, so I encourage you to support financially if that's something that you're able to do. But otherwise, just, you know, like and click everything, help us spread the word. Like, we just want Fat Liberation Month to be a gift to fat community, you know, to fortify people before all of that stupid swimsuit talk starts, and all of the like, oh, we're coming out of lockdown, so you have to lose 30 pounds before you go back to seeing people, like all of that nonsense. We just want to fortify fat people with this month. So please do, you know, like and subscribe and all the things. And then if you want to follow me personally, so on Instagram and all the things, we're NAFA official, and on all the things, I personally am Eye of the Tigress, like letter IOFTHE and then Tigress.
Amazing. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be with you and you know, I told you, like, some of your other podcasts, I'm like, I don't know how I ended up in the company of these people, but I'll take it. I'm super excited about it and so grateful for this space.
I spoke to Tigress back in April. That's months and months ago. And I promised her that I would release the episode before May of 2021, which, as you'll know, I didn't. May was the first ever Fat Liberation Month, and NAFA had a bunch of online projects happening. I wish that I had had the spoons to release this before it happened, but instead, consider me early for May 2022. Put it in your diaries, folks. Oh, and hey, while I have you, if you are considering becoming a Patreon supporter, I think this is the time. Go to patreon.com/SophieHagen, SophieHagen, where you can, for just £5 a month, get a lot of extra bits. You get access to a special Discord chat server where you can chat with other listeners and me. And you get just a bunch of extra stuff like discount codes and videos and secrets and anything that I can get away with handing over to you. And you also get to keep the podcast going. You pay for the episode transcripts for people who are hard of hearing, for the editing, the website costs, the equipment, and to keep it ad-free. That's patreon.com/SophieHagen. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Tigress Osborne for being a great guest. And thank you to Dave Pickering for editing the episode. Speak to you all soon. Bye!